Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 5:14 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is June 4th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I do apologise for recording the video a little later than normal, but I've been writing the Secular Themes review, which I've started doing since last November as an additional courtesy to subscribers, and I created this chart today, which is the MSCI ex-US divided by the S&P 500. But it's the S&P 500 redenominated into euro. So we have, on the one hand, we have a US dollar index that would be potentially beneficial to US dollar investors, and then we have the S&P 500, which would be potentially beneficial to European investors. And we get this long-term chart, and we can see that there was a pronounced period between about 2002 and 2008 when Europe, or that is more correctly, when everything besides the USA outperformed the US by a substantial margin, where that ratio went from 0.1 and change to 0.35. So the rest of the world went up 3.5 times faster than the USA did over that period. And then it peaked in 2008. And since then, we've had a lot of false dawns. And there was a bit of messing around in between 2008 and 2011, when both areas did equally bad. But from about 2011 onwards, the USA outperformed in a rather spectacular manner. And arguably, that trend is still intact, although we've certainly seen over the course of the last 12 months that everything besides the USA has done better than the USA, or at least done better than the S&P 500. And I do think that's a particularly relevant differentiation to make, because what it's really saying is that the S&P 500 is dominated by a small number of companies, and that small number of companies that are extraordinarily large in terms of their market caps contributed a lot of the outperformance over the course of the last decade. And the FANGs are the darlings of the investment community still, and they represent significant weightings because of the weights that they occupy within indices like the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ 100. But the big thing that stands out is the timing of that outperformance for Europe between 2002 and 2008. Because if we look at the dollar index, then what we're presented with is this long-term chart, which seems to have a great deal of cyclicality. But one thing that's abundantly clear is that the dollar peaked in 2002, or really in 2001, and retested the peak in early 2002, and then trended lower in a significant manner all the way through to 2008. So the clear outperformance of Europe and its attraction as an investment destination, and the clear outperformance of Asia and emerging markets and commodity-led markets, was in large part a function of the decline of the dollar and the clear desire of US dollar investors to hedge their exposure to the currency. So we're at a potentially critical juncture today. There's still a lot of argument about whether the dollar should bounce in a profound manner from here or decline in a profound manner. And where one comes down on that argument is going to have a significant bearing on how one views the rest of the world and the potential returns from different asset classes. I place myself in the camp of being dollar bearish. There's at least a few reasons for that. The first is that we have the cyclicality. And the cyclicality of the dollar with 7 good years and 7 bad years and a couple of years of messing around in between has been going on for at least 40 years. So it's going to take a lot to really break that cyclicality. So we certainly had the 7 years on the upside from the 1978 to 1985. We had 7 years on the downside heading into the 1992 period. Then we had some messing around the bottoms, and we definitely had this messing around the bottoming phases. But then from 1995, we had a big run up into the peak in 2002. Then we had 2002 down to 2008, which wasn't quite the 7 years, all depending on if you take the absolute peak or the beginning of the downtrend. But from 2001 down to 2008, certainly 7 years, you get a bit of messing around in between again, and then you get a meaningful low in 2011, and then it goes up into the period of 2016, 17, or arguably all the way up into are again some messing around and this meaningful peak in 2020. Now if we just simply zoom in, well, we've had this extremely long range. It's been going onwards now for more than 5 years, and we had a brief flurry of interest in the dollar yesterday, and it did pop on the upside, and then it gave up a lot of that advance in here today. So it's able to rally on for a couple of days, but then we're not seeing the big upper dynamics, and we're certainly not seeing a lot of follow through. And it encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean back in March and April, and subsequently has come back down to the lows. So it's not especially encouraging, but it's an awfully big level, this 90 area. And it's been spending a fair amount of time around it, nearly 6 months now. So it's logical to think that there is certainly the potential for short-term support. But the bigger picture here is of a potentially developing Type 3 top formation. And a Type 3 top is defined by ranging time and size. So if we go back and think about the market in those terms, we had a big breakout from the base formation in 2014. And then it kept on going until 2017, and subsequently had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, got right back up to test the previous peak, and then failed. So we have ranging for 5 years. We have a very big pattern overall. On the very long-term pattern, these are lower highs. And now we're right in the region of the lows. Well, so there's potential here that this is a Type 3 top formation. And if it breaks the neckline and drops below 90 on a sustained basis, well, then we have confirmation that the peak is in. And then we can think that from the perspective of a US dollar investor, then any positive return in any international market is going to be flattered by the devaluation of the currency. So this is one of the things that international investors like. They like to have capital market appreciation, currency appreciation, and a higher yield to take home. And when they can get all three, well, then they increase their positions. And international investors had exactly that triumvirate of positive aspects to investing in the USA for most of the last decade. But now the interest rate differential is gone. The continued willingness to run these extraordinary deficits, and whether that is on the monetary front or the fiscal front, the massive deficits in terms of trade, and the willingness of the Federal Reserve to also print money with abandon. And then we're also potentially looking at the introduction of universal basic income by fiat. This certainly hasn't been voted on, but the clear response to the pandemic was to do absolutely everything necessary to support the consumer. The USA went the support the consumer route. Europe went towards the support companies route, and therefore support the worker by ensuring they're not fired by supporting the companies. But nonetheless, the region or the reality is that the USA is now at a point where it's running these extraordinary deficits, and it has these outstanding problems about how do you take something away when someone's become used to it. And these outsized unemployment benefits and the moratoriums on evictions have been ongoing now for more than a year, and they don't have a ready answer for how to change it. So a number of states are already on the way to removing the excessive unemployment benefits, but we're still not at the end of it. And employment figures are continuing to disappoint. They're certainly coming in positive territory, and creating 500,000 jobs is better than losing 500,000, there's no question about that. But the reality is that as long as people are getting paid more from doing nothing than they do from working, they don't have a rational reason for going back to work. And when you're unemployed, you also have access to free health care and a lot of other ancillary benefits. So the reality is that until there are substantive measures taken to address this huge mismatch between what's possibly earned through work and what can be achieved from doing nothing at all, then it's unlikely that hiring is going to pick up in a significant way, regardless of how many job openings there are. So the only other potential outcome is that they raise wages. I was reading an article earlier on today, I saw it on my phone, and it was to the effect that the law sector, the banking sector, for associates and for people with longer tenure, somewhere in the region of about 8 years of experience, the starting package now is upwards of $500,000. And what's particularly relevant, it's not so much that they're expected to work day and night to achieve those goals, but rather that that was something that people aspired to in the past, and now it's the low bar. So it's not simply that we're seeing wages rising in the minimum wage sector, but in the professional sector, where there is a shortage of workers and where business has improved, there's certainly outsized demand for people. And that's going to be inflationary because, and we can see how that works in cities like London, where you have the years when the city individuals get big bonuses, then it has a positive impact on the property markets because they go out and buy expensive houses, or they go out and buy expensive cars, or they go out and buy expensive boats. And it has a virtuous circle in terms of that demand growth. Well, we're at an interesting juncture then because the dollar is just about hanging on, and we are definitely starting to see other markets perking up. So rather than first look at the S&P 500 or the European indices, let's look at the S&P 500. It was up in a robust manner in here today, and it continues to trend higher, and we are right in the region of the trend mean. And it was also led higher by some of the larger companies like Tesla and Biogen. When we then think about some of the somewhat smaller companies, then some of the pandemic champions like DocuSign, well, tend to think of these types of companies. DocuSign was the best performer on the S&P 500 today. I made abundant use of DocuSign when we were making offers on houses and buying our home. because it just was so expedient for the realtor to prepare contracts, send them over. It was taking minutes rather than having to countersign in a physical manner. So this is the kind of company that will survive because it provides an ease of use case, and that's going to be beneficial for everybody. I remain negatively predisposed towards Zoom Media, but it has been up for 4 consecutive weeks, and it was up again rather impressively in here today. So I don't know of anybody who enjoys Zoom meetings, and I certainly hear from my children that they can't wait to get back to physical school and never want to go on another Zoom meeting. And I think that as the world opens up, then these types of companies where people were forced to take their products are going to eventually have difficulty in sustaining their product or their sales growth, not to mind just staying in business. When we just think about that in terms of performance, well, there is going to be also this clear interest rate sensitivity to companies that don't make profits. But bond yields are in fact coming down, and yields were negative today by about 7 basis points, which is the largest downward dynamic we've seen in months. So certainly there is increasing potential here that investors are willing to take the Federal Reserve at their word, and that inflationary pressures will moderate. And lumber prices were limit down today. We've certainly had a lot of volatility, and the price, having been limit up 2 days ago, is starting to give up that advance. We're also seeing that the commodity complex is getting some consolidation, but I don't think that this is necessarily any particularly bearish signal, but rather that copper prices got all the way up to a new all-time high, and now we're getting some consolidation. The bigger picture, though, is that prices have been going sideways for 15 years. So there is certainly the potential that we get some consolidation, but there is a new use case for the commodity. And I tend to think of this very much in terms of deja vu. Because the dollar peaked in 2002 after 9/11, and the clear willingness of the Federal Reserve to hold interest rates down and to attempt to fuel an economic recovery through outsized money supply growth and low interest rates. And they achieved that goal, and then they also helped to inflate a real estate bubble, which eventually created the conditions for the credit crisis in 2008. Well, I think it's quite likely that that is exactly what's going to happen on this occasion as well. So they don't want to raise interest rates, and they are worried about the fact that the number of people jumping back into the workforce is lower than expected, and they are also worried about the potential that this question of how are people going to be evicted from homes that they are not paying mortgages or rents on has not been addressed. And then, of course, there is the big question about whether we are in fact in a universal basic income environment. And it looks like that is potentially where things are going. And even if, and perhaps the number one thing that would introduce that kind of outcome is simply taking away those unemployment benefits and the fiscal distress that that would cause for so many people, where they would simply see their household balance sheets take a massive hit. Well, then if it comes to voting in the midterm elections or in the presidential election, well, they are going to be much more likely to support the person that's promoting universal basic income. So that could quite easily be the upshot of the pandemic, that we move into something approaching a universal basic income environment. And if that's the case, well, it's likely that in order to fund it, the dollar will have to break down. And it will be a fundamental tailwind for all hard assets. So copper is a big one of those. It's a hard asset. But of course, it also has new use cases. And those new use cases are in the renewable energy sector. So we have electric vehicles. What I thought was really interesting this week was how well Ford did on the back of the fact that they're now producing more electric Mustangs than petrol Mustangs. So the share was a little softer in here today, but it has now clearly broken what was effectively a 6-year downtrend. And it has done so in a really dynamic manner. So it's coming right back up to the upper side of this base formation. And we would really need to see a significant source of trending consistency to question that this isn't a broader based recovery. Well, Tesla was in positive territory today, but it is underperforming. And it certainly helps if I type correctly. It's underperforming over most of this year so far, and it is now enduring some competition from the kinds of companies it was relying on to fuel its growth through selling them carbon credits. So it's losing its monopoly on the sale of carbon credits. At the same time, it's losing market share because its competitors are also building electric vehicles, and not everyone wants a Tesla. And then, of course, it has its challenges with China, where having been welcomed in and shared its technology, it's looking at large numbers of of competitors. And I'm going to put up the BYD price, but I'm being given the gaming company. So I'm going to find it another way. But what I also want to do is to go through a large number of shares for companies, and then to look at them over very long-term periods. I am struggling to rem ah, there we go. There, the memory kicked back in. So BYD also surged in 2020, and now it has completed a reversion to the mean, and it is firming up once more. There's certainly some signs of activity in Chinese markets. There was a concerted effort to try and curtail the expansion of the extremely large companies. So those like Tencent are still struggling to rebound. But BYD is pretty much squarely in the crosshairs of the kinds of companies that the Communist Party want to prevail. China wants to become the global leader in electric vehicles. So they have picked their champions, and they're going to do whatever it takes to ensure that they survive in much the same way that they did with the solar sector. And that just sounds like good business. Now, there's a big difference between solar and the wind sector, because large numbers of solar companies, they promote their businesses. And I started getting I've been getting notes in the mail for or adverts in the mail for years now saying, well, we can install them for free. And it'll reduce your energy bills. So what it really means is that the solar company is at fronting the upfront costs, and they have to bear that until the panels are in fact paid back, and that payback period can be upwards of 5 years. So in that 5 years, they have a lot of interest rate sensitivity. If interest rates are going down, which looks to be likely in the short term, then that should be beneficial for these types of companies that are very interest rate sensitive. When they can go off and borrow at extremely low rates and then sell and get a guaranteed cash flow in 5 years' time through installing solar panels on people's homes, well, they'll do that all day, all week, all month, all year. And we can anticipate that's exactly what they'll do. Of course, when interest rates rise, well, then they don't make nearly as much money. And it puts a big hole in that business model. So as interest rates went up in the early part of this year, then the solar sector start pulled back in a rather abrupt manner because of that interest rate sensitivity. But then we can think about the wind sector. It also endured a process of mean reversion, but the pullback has been less deep, and it has just put in a higher reaction low, and it's certainly outperforming solar. And a good part of the reason for that is the wind sector, despite the fact that the cost of copper continues to rise and it's a significant input cost in the production of these big turbines, well, it does not have the same interest rate sensitivity because they're not selling subscriptions. They are instead looking to install a utility size apparatus. Then, when we think about the utilities sector, well, it has classically been viewed as a bond proxy, and it continues to trend higher, and it's not really all that far away from the all-time peaks. I do think that there is a greater value in mid-caps and small-caps, and that is true internationally as well. So the Russell 2000 surged in 2020, and it's been ranging for most of the last 6 months, but it's still a very clear trend overall. Now let's look at some of these long-term charts for international markets, because European markets are finally starting to look like they're capable of rallying, and it's been a long time coming. So the Euro Stoxx index, you can very clearly see that euro-denominated stocks did spectacularly well between 2003 and 2008, or really the end of 2007. The euro bottomed after the dismal launch of the currency, and then it rallied meaningfully, and investors were sucked into European markets because they got the currency market yield and capital market appreciation. So now we can think about how the euro is doing, and Europe might not want to have a strong currency, but they don't seem willing to do what's necessary to devalue it either. And other areas, particularly the USA, are much more interested in having a weak currency. So that's exactly what we're seeing today with the euro. It's firming from the region of the trend mean. And then the only country that is seems to be doing more than the USA to devalue its currency is Japan. And the dollar here is consolidating above the trend mean, and it looks like a bullish pattern overall. This looks like a bullish consolidation. Now, every other time it has been able to push back above the trend mean, it's failed. So we're at a rather interesting juncture because if the yen can firm through 110 and hold the move, well, then that will clearly break the overall a downtrend for the dollar, and it will create demand for Japanese assets. What I find particularly interesting, though, is Japan has been in this long base formation for what really feels like forever, 30 years. But from the perspective of a dollar investor, the market is at new all-time highs, and it's consolidating in the region of the trend mean, and it looks like it's about to hold this breakout. So Japan is immediately becoming more interesting from a foreign investor's perspective. And then we can think about higher growth markets like Vietnam. Of course, Vietnam has been one of the economies that has really been the champion of investors, because it has rebounded so emphatically from the lows in 2020. It has been able to sidestep the ravages of the pandemic. And in local currency terms, it's breaking on the upside and pushing out to new high ground and exceeding the peak from 2007. And then in currency adjusted terms, because of the weakness of the dong over the course of the last decade, we're only now just pushing up and towards the peaks. But putting into perspective that dollar decline, it's noteworthy, for example, that the Vietnamese dong is in fact trending higher against the dollar. And it hasn't done that before. There was a brief time in 2007 when the dong appreciated, and after that, it depreciated in a significant manner, and it's lost nearly 50% of its value over the course of the last decade. And now it's appreciating because Vietnam is running a significant trade surplus, and the number of things that the and the variety of different items that Vietnam is exporting to the rest of the world continues to increase. I tend to compare the Communist Party in charge of Vietnam to China's Communist Party, but 30 years ago. And they are very business oriented and they want to improve living standards and they're willing to do whatever is necessary to achieve those goals. They don't have the vanity projects and they don't have the idealism and that the Chinese Communist Party has right now. It is worth thinking, though, that thinking about the fact that China's MSCI index, which has a broad spectrum of Chinese investments, is pushing on to or pushing away from the trend mean, but it's been going sideways for a very long time, and this also looks like a consolidation in the region of historic peaks. So it's you have to go all the way back to 1994 to see when China had been performing in this particular level. It tested the peak from 94 and then pulled back, but this continues to look like a consolidation overall. Then when we think about the Nifty index, well, again, India's currency has been something that really weighed on the market during the decade from 2008 through to 2019 and 20. And since 2020, it has broken out and continues to rally. So, in local currency terms, the market has been hard to beat. And from a local currency or and a nominal perspective, Indian investors were reasonably well compensated instead of going off and taking risks overseas. But if the dollar starts compressing, then domestic investors would have no reason to go to the USA. And they would be better suited staying at home. And US investors would be better off investing abroad. So these are the kinds of things that are happening now in the wider global markets. When we think about Brazil, it's an even more exaggerated version of this exact same argument, because in local currency terms, the Bovespa is pushing new highs. But even when we think about it in terms of Australian dollars, it's been, and the Aussie dollar was weak for a good portion of the last decade, it is still ranging in just about all other currencies. So the US dollar has got the potential to trend lower. If that, then of course the Brazilian real could trend higher, and you have higher interest rates, higher growth rates, and the potential for a commodity-led bull market to drive interest into Brazil. Well, let's just think about what is it that Brazil exports? Well, a large part of it is iron ore, and they haven't been particularly effective at doing that recently. Iron ore prices are still in the region of their peaks, and it's been a profound advance over the course of the last year. Then, of course, we have, well, we looked at copper already. We have soybeans. Soybeans had the step lower on the contract change on the front month in here this week. If we look at the second month contract, then I think we get a better understanding of exactly what's going on here. It looks like a long range, and that range has been forming for more than a decade. And what we are potentially looking at is another step higher in production costs. Well, it's easy to explain where that step higher in production costs is coming from when we look at oil prices. So, oil prices went negative for a brief time last year. They have rebounded in an impressive manner, and the price right now is holding around the $70 area. We are still at a fraction of the peak value from 2008, but it still looks like a recovery overall. The tide of public opinion and political opinion has certainly turned against oil, and it is the new villain. And I think that that is particularly interesting because the villain of regulators and the wider public over the last 13 years have been banks. And in the aftermath of the credit crisis, they were or regulations were heaped upon the banking sector, and the banks were considered just undesirable investment destinations. People didn't want to work at a bank or admit that they worked at a bank for a good long time, and it was just a real lost decade for the entire financial complex as balance sheets were rebuilt in the aftermath of the credit crisis. Well, now we're looking at the oil price, and the oil companies are being vilified as being among the biggest polluters in the world and poisoning the earth that we all share, and being held liable for any form of pollution that they have performed anywhere in the world. So, the oil companies, though, have been among the best performers so far this year, as we saw this profound rebound, because in the teeth of the pandemic in early 2020, they were being priced as if they were going out of business. So we saw for a brief while that the yield on ExxonMobil was in excess of 11%, and the last time it yielded that low was ahead of the big bull market starting in the early 1980s. But the challenge for the energy sector is that they are going to be under extraordinary pressure. They're going to have the same pressure heaped upon them that was imposed upon the automotive sector. So there are going to be companies that get to sell carbon credits to the oil companies to offset their emissions, and they're going to have to pay for them, and emissions prices are on a secular trend higher despite the weakness that we've had over the last 3 weeks. And let me just put that chart up. The European emissions prices have been, that's very weird. I don't exactly know why it's not working. So let me see if I can find it a different way. And we'll just look at the active contract instead. Don't know why it has moved from the second month. So I can definitely find, well, I'm going to post my own chart of that in comment of the day today. It's been pulling back over the last 3 weeks. It's overbought in the short term, and there's certainly potential that we could have some weakness. But Europeans want to have the price double. They want it at 100 euros. And they want to impose that tax upon the energy companies. So, on the one hand, the companies themselves are going to be reluctant to continue to invest. So, that will support prices. But eventually, prices are going to rise enough that it will encourage supply back into the market. One thing we can certainly think about is that we're likely to see a lot of investment in commodities, and energy is a major component in the production of just about all commodities. So it's beneficial for oil if we get this last hurrah in terms of the investment in new supply, new energy supply, and the renewable energy supply, or green hydrogen, or more uranium. I saw that Bill Gates is going to build a next generation nuclear plant in Wyoming. I saw that headline yesterday. So there's certainly interest in the energy sector. Oil prices remain steady, but the continued outperformance of the energy sector, I think, is questionable. But of course, as long as oil prices are continuing to rally, then that should be beneficial for the sector because it is still trading at a discount overall. But then we should also pay attention to the financial sector because banks were the least loved of all sectors for most of the last decade, but the financials ETF has now completed what was a very lengthy range, and it is pushing on to new high ground. And it's also a measure of just how much public sentiment has moved on. That when the CEOs of banks were being grilled in Congress in the USA this week, they weren't being asked about financial controls or risk guidelines, or how they are setting money aside to deal with potential problems. Rather, they were instead being asked about how are they benefiting society. And banks have a ready answer for that question because they can say, well, we make loans to people so that they can build their businesses and buy a home or buy a car and improve their standard of living. And they get a pass on their fees, and they get a pass on all of their previous sins, because in order to achieve the utopian goals of the environmental movement and the social justice warriors, well, you need lots of money, and banks are liquidity providers. So as long as banks continue to do well, then we're still in a bull market. And this again is like deja vu from the early part of the 2000s. It was banks that started to take off and run, and it was the dollar that started to trend lower, and international markets really started to take off after China was inducted into the WTO, and they benefited enormously from the weakness of the currency, of the dollar, and then the outsized demand for commodities. Well, it's unlikely to be China that is the big outlier in terms of demand for commodities. But just I think a lot about the speech that the CEO of Fortescue gave a couple of months ago, where he's basically betting the company on the development of green hydrogen, and they're not borrowing money for it, they're doing it from cash flow. So this is a significant investment in a brand new technology, and it's going to require massive investment in infrastructure all over the world to deliver on recharging facilities, on additional electricity generation capacity, and then also to build out all those batteries and all of that generating and the motors and the wind turbines and the solar panels and the uranium. And what I find also interesting is that the uranium ETF is now trending higher in a more convincing manner. And Cameco continues to push on the upside as well. So there's certainly interest in the energy sector overall. I'm going to put this back into local currencies. But then we can think about the Canadian market. It's a major banking sector, and it's also got a major energy sector. In local currency terms, the stock market is certainly doing well. But what I thought this was a particularly interesting chart, that the Canadian dollar has been quite weak over most of the last decade, and it's actually now only just breaking higher in US dollar terms. And the again, another major developed economy like Australia, the ASX 200 has already popped on the upside, but in US dollar terms, it's really only been going sideways. So we're only at the dawn of this migration, and the interest in international markets is likely to pick up significantly because it's not just copper and oil that are doing well. All of the industrial resources are doing better. And the tin price has clearly broken on the upside and is now approaching the region of the peaks from back in 2011. So this is a very impressive rebound in a very similar manner to what we had in 2010. The big difference on this occasion is that we had the big rebound in terms of the recovery from the credit crisis and the demand that emerged from ASEAN and the emerging markets in 2010 and 11. And then the dollar turned and it started to appreciate in a significant manner, and that sapped demand for currency, for commodities, and the dollar funding costs of emerging markets increased, and then that really contributed to a significant peak in most indices. So we can think about, for example, the Indonesian market, where it really did spectacularly well all the way up to 2011. And in nominal terms, it's still going higher. But the devaluation of the rupiah after 2011 really contributed more to a range overall. And the market is really only just beginning to fire and starting to rally now in a dynamic manner from the region of the trend mean. So there is certainly evidence of greater demand for these higher growth markets with the potential for higher interest rates, and then also the potential for stronger currencies. And China might not want to have the strongest currency in the world, but they also have a domestic inflation problem, and domestic considerations will certainly be more important than international considerations. Of course, it will not have escaped the attention of veteran subscribers that the continued bull market in emerging markets coincided with the bull market in precious metals and commodities in the early 2000s. And again, that's exactly what we're seeing on this occasion. And on this occasion, gold broke upwards first. So it was one of the first movers. And it's been going through a painful consolidation over the course of the last 9 months. But it firmed rather well from the region of the trend mean this week. It has broken its downtrend overall. And I think that the gold in purchasing power parity terms is perhaps the most interesting of all the charts used to compare with gold, because We saw this. It's really a retest of the peak if we look at this on a daily basis in 2011. And now we've had a much bigger advance over the course of this just the last couple of months. So I think that it is quite likely that gold is going to break on the upside in not just in nominal terms, but in purchasing power parity terms, and that it will exceed the peak put in 2011, potentially this year, and then run on the upside. Commodity bull markets and are really defined best in terms of the rising cost of marginal production. So we had supply elasticity meets rising demand as being the causal factor behind the big push on the upside and the step change in commodity pricing in the early portion of the 2000s. What we're instead seeing today is something a little different. On the one hand, what we have is a significant change in the supply of money. So that's again very reminiscent of what we had in the early 1970s, where there was a clear change in terms of how governments appreciated the risks from deficits. And they had restive populations and they wanted to placate them, so they spent money. And it was the clear intention to simply print their way out of trouble that created the inflationary problems that contributed to the rampant inflation in the late 1970s. And it looks increasingly likely that that's exactly what we are in right now. We're at the point where we have restive populations and we have a reticence among the elected elites to do anything to disrupt the social order. So they're going to print their way out of trouble, and they're going to give people what they want, which is more money. And that is creating demand for everything, and it is leading to the rising cost of production. So that is contributing to this step change in terms of the rising cost of production. When we then think about the mining sector, it also means that when Glencore say that they're not going to invest in additional new supply of copper until prices are at $15,000 a ton, well, they're only at 10,000 now, and you have a major producer saying that they don't want to invest in new supply. So the way that companies are getting over the regulatory burdens is to simply buy out their competitors, but that doesn't increase supply. Prices have to rally significantly further in order to encourage supply into the market. And we're just not yet at that point. There is nobody talking about big greenfield new projects. The only people who are talking about that are Chinese. For example, they have finally are the Simandou project in Guinea in West Africa has been through large numbers of hands, and lots of companies have found themselves being accused of bribery because or whatever the reason is. I mean, how anyone thinks that you can do business in places with low standards of governance without bribing key officials is rather silly. But China now has control of the Simandou mining site, and they're building an iron ore mine. And they want to create their own source of supply for a key commodity, which is exactly what the Japanese did in the 1980s. But then, of course, there's the rising cost of production. Until they, in fact, get that mine online, then they're going to have to pay whatever is asked of them by the market. And that's just one commodity. They have also been able to effectively curtail the rising cost of production in nickel by developing new technologies for pig nickel. So that is also an innovation that has helped to control prices. Nobody has come up with a way to substitute for lumber. So the price there surged on the upside, and I think it's quite likely that we're now looking at another step change. And the last step change happened in the early 1990s. We had this explosive breakout, and subsequently prices held the breakout. So on this occasion, I think it's quite likely that prices will hold the breakout. We're unlikely to see prices come back down below the $600 area. Of course, that's half what the price is now, and we will have occasions when prices will rise on a temporary basis. The things that are driving the rising cost of production are, on the one hand, regulatory, so that we just simply decide that the cost is going to rise, and then it happens. And then there are the kinds of conditions that occur where we have no control. So droughts have certainly helped to sustain the breakout in the copper price. Sugar prices are also firming, and I don't want to make predictions about the weather, but we know that the number of hurricanes has been increasing. The hurricane season is starting earlier. The seas are warming, and there is a calcification trend. The Pacific salmon, I guess shoal, is declining. It's beginning to exhibit the same kinds of conditions that the cod fisheries did before they collapsed, and obviously that would have a profound effect on the Pacific Northwest for Canada and Alaska. So, of course, that would also contribute to rising costs of production, and it would also create demand for more farmed food. So we can think about SalMar, where we've had certainly some volatility in the share, but it is continuing to push on the upside. So food producers and processors continue to do well. And again, this is also a reflection of exactly the same kinds of trends we saw in the early 2000s. It was the food processors really did extremely well, and the veggie ETF is continuing to trend higher in a steep manner. And it was in positive territory again in here today. Well, these are all risk assets, and it's very representative of a significant rotation. When we look at the performance of the Wilshire index in 5,000 index, so the total market index for the USA, well, it is still trending higher, and it's trending higher in a really quite a steep manner. So this isn't necessarily a story about the underperformance of US assets. They should do well in nominal terms. It's simply that on a currency adjusted basis, then they will likely do less well. So when we look at the Wilshire 5000 in euro terms, it's still trending higher, but not in as impressive a manner as it does in US dollars. So there are certainly opportunities that will arise in the US. But then we can think about the largest companies. It's these extremely large companies where people have this hope for continued growth, but they're not going up. And Amazon has been ranging now for the better part of a year. And of course, anyone who's been owning the share knows that it is capable of doing this, and it's done it in the past. And then it has accelerated on the upside. But we are approaching periods now where it's relevant to talk about the law of large numbers. Because Amazon has a market cap of 1.6 trillion, and there is massive potential for doublings in lots of assets. But for Amazon to double, it would have to have a market cap of 3.2 trillion. And that's a lot of money. And it would have to come from somewhere. So, in order to justify continuing to have an overweight position in some of these mega cap shares, one would have to first believe that there's going to be massive money printing and that the sheer volume of money to be printed will dwarf the expected return from a company like Amazon, so that it could have its market cap double because the sheer volume of new money will be way in excess of the quantity required for a doubling. It's not beyond the bounds of possibility. We're still in a very liquid environment, and governments are still printing money, and none more so than the USA and Japan. But that's also an uncertainty. And it's just, if we think about the law of small numbers, it's a lot easier to double from 1 to 2 than it is from 1.6 trillion to 3.2 trillion. And that's also particularly relevant for Bitcoin, because I continue to see these arguments about how much larger the cryptocurrency markets can get. And when we start talking about trillions, those trillions have to come from somewhere. So we've had a massive amount of liquidity created in the last 12 months, and that propelled Bitcoin up to a market cap of a trillion. But nobody at $60,000 was happy with a trillion. What they were beginning to estimate was that Bitcoin would soon have a price of 500,000. So they are implying that its market cap would be in the order of 10 trillion. So that's all well and good, but where does that 10 trillion come from? So in order to justify that valuation, you would have to either assume that the currencies of every other country in the world are simply going to collapse in value, or that the supply of whatever currency one is looking at will massively accelerate, and that instead of the market cap of 10 trillion for Bitcoin being a big number, rather it would be a small number relative to the money supply that had been created in that time. Well, in order to get to that kind of market cap, we would need a profound crisis. And we've just had one. So now the bigger question is there a real argument that we're going to have another giant crisis less than a couple of years after the most recent one? Historically, it's been it's unlikely. Well, that would suggest that it's going to be difficult for these extremely large companies to continue to propel themselves higher. It's more likely that the smaller companies with higher growth prospects are going to do better. There is the potential that the extremely large companies might attempt to buy their growth by buying those smaller companies, which would further enhance the potential for those companies to do well. So I think that there is plenty of opportunity, and there is likely to be a lot of money made in the markets over the course of the next few years. We're still in a very benign environment. The things that people were worried about ahead of the pandemic, where we had the reality of quantitative tightening, where high yield spreads were starting to rise, where liquidity conditions were tightening, and where we'd already had a problem with the repo markets. So it was looking increasingly likely that we were on recession watch. Well, the kinds of things that we watch for recessions, none of them are really troublesome at present. So there's no prospect of a recession, and central banks are still not raising rates. And even when they start raising rates, they're not going to do that until growth is firing on all cylinders. So I agree with the people who worry about a bubble, but not about the timing of the worry, because we're in the inflation portion of the bubble, and most markets are only just beginning to break out in currency adjusted terms. So the big arbiter is going to be the dollar. If the dollar breaks down, then everything outside the USA is going to get a significant tailwind. If the dollar doesn't break down, well, then the US will continue to outperform. But one thing that I can certainly say is that the best predictions that we've made in this service have been based on commonality. And the commonality that we have in international markets, ex-US, is extremely high. The commonality then with commodity prices and the outperformance of financials and gold, that all suggests that there's going to be a significant tailwind and that the relative attraction of investing in the USA is not going to be as convincing as it was in the decade up to the recent peaks, even if it is still appreciating in nominal terms. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.